You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy. Hi, and welcome back to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas. We are joined today by Dr. Larry Pilevsky, who I had the fortune to meet recently at a MAPS conference in Scottsdale, Arizona. And he made this really fantastic presentation on ADHD that connected a couple of dots for me, especially on the overlap with ADHD and PANS. And I was so excited to talk to him. And he agreed to join us for the podcast. So I'm very excited to have him here. Let me tell you guys just a little bit about him before we get started. So Dr. Pilevsky is a New York State licensed pediatrician who utilizes a holistic approach to children's wellness and illness. Dr. Pilevsky received his medical degree from the New York University School of Medicine in 1987, completed a three-year pediatric residency at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City in 1990, and served as a pediatric fellow in the ambulatory care outpatient department at Bellevue Hospital in New York City from 1990 to 91. Since 1991, his clinical experience includes working in pediatric emergency and intensive care medicine, inpatient and outpatient pediatric medicine, neonatal intensive care medicine, newborn and delivery room medicine, and conventional holistic and integrative pediatric private practice. Dr. Pilevsky is a diplomate of the American Board of Integrative Holistic Medicine and past president of the American Holistic Medical Association. He received his pediatric board certification in 1990 and passed his pediatric board recertification exams in 97, 2004, and 2011. In his current pediatric practice, Dr. Pilevsky offers well-child examinations, consultations, and educational programs to families and practitioners in the areas of preventative and holistic health, childhood development, lifestyle changes, nutrition for adults, infants, and children, safe alternative treatments for common and difficult to treat acute and chronic pediatric and adult conditions, vaccination controversies, mindful parenting, and rethinking the medical paradigm. Additionally, he teaches holistic integrative pediatric and adolescent medicine to parents and medical and allied health professionals, both nationally and internationally, and is available for speaking engagements worldwide. You can hear Dr. Pilevsky on his weekly podcast, Critically Thinking with Dr. T and Dr. P, on Thursday evenings at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and can listen to more of his podcasts and interviews by visiting drpilevsky.com. And we will put links to all of that and all sorts of ways that you can get in touch with this man who has been very busy in his life. So that if you are just intrigued by what he's sharing today, lots of ways that you can get in touch with him. So welcome, Dr. Larry. We're so excited to have you here and joining us
today.
Thank
you very much. It was a pleasure meeting you in Scottsdale. I enjoyed our conversation, and I am very honored that you invited me to share in this podcast. So thank you.
Dr. Larry, get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself and what brought you to integrative medicine.
Well, it's interesting because whenever anybody asks me what got me into holistic medicine, what got me into integrative medicine, I actually turn it around and I say, I didn't get into it. It got into me. And what I mean by that is that I was always a child and a young adult who asked questions, sometimes painstakingly to professors, to teachers, to adults, because I never just took what they said to me at face value. I needed more, and I was always thinking several steps ahead. So in the early 90s, when I was an ER physician, and I started seeing kids in the emergency room who would come back after a course of antibiotics and they would be sick again. And I'd give them another course of antibiotics and then they'd be sick again 2 weeks later. And I was taught that they need another course of antibiotics because they still have an ear infection or they still have a cough. I started to realize, wait a second, these kids don't look sick. Why would I give them another course of antibiotics? So what's really going on? And so I started investigating alternative ways of approaching it. And so I met pediatric ear, nose, and throat doctors who were utilizing literature from Europe since 1990 of other ways to look at ear infections. And then I started learning about nutrition. And then I started practicing nutrition. And then I started going to a chiropractor. And I started going to an acupuncturist. And I started training with an acupuncturist, and I started learning about homeopathy, and I started working with naturopaths, and I started investigating all this stuff that I didn't know. And by the late 90s, somebody came up to me, a mother, and said, "Dr. Larry, did you know that there's mercury in vaccines?" And everything stopped. And having started medical school in 1983 and then hearing in 1998, 15 years later, what was in vaccines and what I was not told, it just opened up a Pandora's box because I took the oath of first do no harm. And I realized that that was my obligation, first and foremost. My obligation was not to the medical boards. It was not to the state. It was not to the government. It was to the kids. And I had to protect them. And the more I started learning, the more I started realizing something's wrong here. And then in the early 2000s, it became crystal clear to me that nutrition must be the primary piece of pediatric and adult medicine, and that children get sick for the purposes of clearing out their body of excess waste, toxins, impurities, and inflammation to prevent their bodies from getting seriously ill if those wastes, toxins, impurities, and inflammation were to stay inside the body. And that just shifted my whole practice. And so I rarely use over-the-counter medicines. I don't use any over-the-counter medicines. They're not safe. I don't suppress symptoms. I support the body to clear itself out. And I don't see illnesses as infection for the most part. And so I rarely use pharmaceuticals. And I've been practicing over 25 years with that philosophy and watching kids just blossom. Because most often, if you let an acute illness run its course, looking for specific things that would tell you something is going wrong, support them through it, they grow, they develop, they mature, they prune their immune systems and their nervous systems, and they fly. That's what they're meant to do, is fly.
Yeah, like we talked about earlier, and like we've said many, many, many times on this podcast, that we have slightly different approaches, which I can't wait to have an opportunity to talk to you more and learn more about the things that you know and what you're seeing in your practice, but that we agree in general that like it's not about infections. The infection isn't necessarily the problem. And what we say here, it's not strep, it's susceptibility. It's not X, Y, or Z, it's susceptibility. And that's basically what you're talking about. And lots of different things that go into that is what we've talked about. So, and speaking of which, there's an approach that you shared with us in your presentation about ADHD that really like turned like a couple of lights on for me, things that I hadn't really thought about for ADHD before. So let's talk about that, because there's so many kids who have ADHD that is being like either alongside PANS or, you know, like sort of combined in with it or underlying a PANS presentation. So a lot of parents are just dying to learn more about ADHD. And I think your perspective is really great. So again, like I said, I saw you present on the topic and some great insight on it. Let's start with actually what's happening in the brain with ADHD.
So if you go down the CDC list of what criteria constitutes inattention and what constitutes hyperactivity impulsiveness. When you read all the things about inattentiveness, you realize that the part of the brain that is less functional, the part of the brain that is responsible for executive function and speech and focus and attention and being able to think through a problem, is the part of the brain that's most affected in kids with inattention. And that's the forebrain. That's the front of the brain. That's the part of the brain that is the highest, most developed part of the human species. But when babies are born, that part of the brain is not even functional.
Yeah.
And so over time, that part of the brain has to develop. And so the part of the brain where there's hyperactivity and impulsiveness or impulsivity is the part of the brain that babies start out life with most function, which is the hindbrain, where there's fight or flight, survival, danger, high alert, primitive reflexes, suck, root, quick reactivity, impulsivity, survival, and it's the adrenaline brain. And so what most people who practice this medicine don't recognize is that the hindbrain, which is the primitive brain, the reptilian brain, the adrenaline brain, the survival brain, the there's a danger, I have to move brain, does not allow for the forebrain to function if the hindbrain is dominant. In other words, if there's inflammation, if there's excitement, if there's poor sleep, if there's irritability, if there's aggressiveness, if there's an inability to sit still, if there's all signs of inflammation, adrenaline surges, the hindbrain is dominant. That means that the brain is in its state of survival and perceives a danger, perceives a threat, and has to do whatever it can to run from the threat. But when that's most active, the forebrain shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, a child is not going to focus, not going to pay attention, not going to be organized, not going to have executive function, not going to be able to think through a problem or problem solve. The child is going to be focused on the more primitive parts of the brain, the hindbrain, the reptilian brain, the survival mechanisms. And so when I work with these kids, I have to teach parents that if you want your kid to focus, you can't have a dominant hindbrain. It's not possible. They don't work together. You can't run out of a burning building because your body perceives a threat and sit and read a book at the same time.
Right.
Just won't work physiologically. One is adrenaline and one is the opposite of adrenaline, called acetylcholine or the parasympathetic nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And so in helping these kids, I try to explain to parents that if you want the forebrain to come online, we have to recognize what are the factors in the child's life that may be contributing to persistent adrenaline, a persistent threat, persistent inflammation, persistent hindbrain activity that makes the body perceive that it's in danger. And once we do that, once we start recognizing all of those factors and try to modify them, eliminate them, work with them, the kids get better. Why? Because as the adrenaline and inflammation are reduced, forward brain development occurs. Because the forebrain develops because the hindbrain quiets. So the forebrain develops because the hindbrain is able to make a voluntary movement, have an experience, and then be able to ponder, to consider, to think, to work through, to problem solve. Because the key to quieting the hindbrain dominance is to get rid of the involuntary movements, the inability to sit still, the tics, the fidgeting, the standing up and moving around, all of those things, the aggressive behavior, the impulsivity, those are all involuntary movements. And those involuntary movements are a sign that the body perceives a threat and has to shake it off, has to do something about it. And so the movement is actually a survival mechanism to respond to the fact that the hindbrain perceives that the body's threatened. There's no consciousness to it, which is why when I see kids who can't sit still or are fidgety, I look at the parents and I say, they can't help themselves. Please don't ask them to stop, because it's not a conscious movement. It's a subconscious movement. It's a body physiology that's trying to work out a threat. The same way as if the airway was threatened, you would cough.
Mm-hmm.
The movement, the actual impulsivity, the aggressiveness, the punching, not sitting still, are all signs that the hindbrain, the adrenaline part of the brain, the survival mechanism of the brain, is perceiving that there's a danger. And so once you quiet the danger, You quiet the involuntary movements. Once you quiet the involuntary movements, out of the hindbrain, the child will have a voluntary movement. And with voluntary movements comes experiences. And with experiences comes observation. With observation comes discovery. And with repetitive observation and discovery, you then signal from the hindbrain to the midbrain. Then you signal the development of the forebrain, which says, ah, let me think this through. Let me problem solve. And that's how the forebrain comes back online, when the hindbrain is no longer dominant. And it's a big, big job to figure out many of the factors that the hindbrain develops adrenaline surges from because the body perceives it's in danger.
And what makes kids go hindbrain dominant?
Well, good question. Anytime there's an increased amount of inflammation in the body will send a signal to the survival part of the brain, hindbrain, and say, we're in trouble. And the reaction is always impulsive. The action is always aggressive. The action is always to move, because something is signaling that the body is in danger. Diet is number one, right? So going way back 20, 30, 40 years was the Feingold diet, where the Feingold understood that dyes, preservatives, additives, food colorings, all of these chemicals in the food, once removed from these kids, were no longer, the body was no longer perceiving a danger. So the intestines, which sends signals to the brain all the time. And I really want to stress to anyone listening is that the gut is the first brain sometimes, although we consider it the second brain, but the gut is almost the first brain. So what happens in the gut is the bacteria and the immune cells are like antennas, and they're discerning what's safe and unsafe. And if there's enough unsafety, it's going to send a signal to the survival mechanisms of the brain, we're in trouble. Now, the body doesn't have to know what it is. It just knows that the adrenaline surge has skyrocketed. And so the body is going to respond. We're in danger. And so you'll look at a kid and go, why'd you do that? And the kid's going to go, I don't know. Because some biochemical reaction, immune reaction, was signaled in the gut that said, danger. So the kid did what the kid would do if the kid was in danger, is respond, react, be impulsive, be aggressive, move, shout, scream, punch. And the problem with that, beyond just the dyes, preservatives, additives, food colorings, and chemicals, is the fact that children are developing astronomical food allergies, which often are obvious. But the more important thing is food sensitivities, not so obvious. And that's what parents miss, right? So what you'll see is, say, a kid who had eczema. They went to the allergist, and the allergist said, your child is allergic to dairy and eggs. You take dairy and eggs out. And all of a sudden, the eczema goes away. And a year or two later, you reintroduce the dairy and the eggs. And the kid doesn't have eczema anymore. So the parent thinks allergy's gone. But now the kid can't sit still. Now the kid's calling out in class. Now the kid's not paying attention. Now the kid's aggressive. And the parent can't figure it out. Because in their mind, no more eczema, no more dairy and egg allergy. Au contraire. The body will always do what it can to rid itself of a perceived threat. Previously, the threat went out the skin. Now, the threat is being signaled to the nervous system. And the result is hyperactivity, aggressiveness, impulsivity, shouting out, not sitting still, tics, because the body has to get the crap out of the brain. And so it's important to recognize that allergies and sensitivities don't always go away. Mm-hmm. And in fact, sometimes the allergies are not allergies, they're sensitivities.
Mm-hmm.
Very subtle.
Yeah.
Sleep disorder, bedwetting, snoring at night, enlarged tonsils and adenoids, lots of ear fluid, twisting and turning at night. These are all evidence of probable food reactions that are adverse to the body.
Mm-hmm.
Because Western medicine says, no, diet has nothing to do with your health, the parents go back into their home and keep feeding their kids that food.
Right. And you can find like an inflammatory response from something that is otherwise healthy. And that's, again, where with homeopathy, we do see kids are able to recover from food sensitivities and even food allergies, but it's because we're addressing like their way that their body's reacting to it. And like getting, instead of like eating a strawberry and getting nutrients from it and seeing it as like healthy, that you get that cell danger response that you're describing.
But what you're saying, because I've seen kids do SLIT, sublingual immunotherapy. I've seen them do NAIT, Nambujapat, mm-hmm. allergy elimination techniques. I've seen them do homeopathy. The severity of the response goes away, but it doesn't mean the immune system isn't still revved. You just don't see it as severe. So sometimes, and again, it depends on the kid, it depends on their constitution. Sometimes I still see reactivity that's not recognized as reactivity because mm-hmm. it's not the same as it was before.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. Homeopathy, great. SLIT, NAIT, LDA, LDI, all great. You know, allergy, ART, allergy. I forgot what the R stands for.
I'm trying to remember too.
Response therapy.
Response therapy.
Allergy response therapy. All those things work to reduce the severity of the reaction, but they don't necessarily, unless you really hit that homeopathic remedy at the core of the constitution.
Yeah, if you're doing
right.
Yes. So I will say that, like, a couple of things. Classical homeopathy, as long as you're doing actual individually recommended classical homeopathy and you're seeing it through to the end. We actually have an upcoming episode about the second half of healing, which is, I think, where people miss it, is that they're seeing a reduced response, but still a response, and they're not continuing on to see it through to completion, because we do see people fully recover using homeopathy, but you have to have persistence to see the little things through to the end. Like, it's not just when, like, oh, things aren't horrible now. It's, you got to see it through all the way to the end, to the no reaction.
I love it. And I want to reinforce what Jen is saying for those who are listening. From what I understand from my experience and my studying, my learning,
mm-hmm.
healing occurs in layers.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens when patients are given homeopathy is things always rise to the top, to the mm-hmm. surface. And so if you see improvement, but not full recovery, it mm-hmm. means there's more underneath yep. that needs to rise to the top. So I really want to reinforce for your patients, and I'm sure you've said this before, but it doesn't hurt to repeat it. Stay mm-hmm. with it, because remember, homeopaths get the right remedy maybe 80% of the time, which is a great percentage, but stay with it, because it's an amazing craft that really creates the higher vibrational healing that children need. And it yeah. is amazing, amazing treatment. So I'm plugging it for you. Even if nobody knows me, I think it's brilliant. If someone is a classical homeopath, I go like this, here. Well, because I don't have to do it. I just know, I know the value of it. So I'll refer and I just to plug it. So
no, we love that and appreciate that so much. So I have to, I don't know if you remember this. I don't know if I stood out to you when you were presenting. I was like right in front of you and I was knitting the whole time. And so I perhaps not a surprise to you, as you watched me knit through your entire presentation. I was recently diagnosed with ADHD late as an adult, things that were missed. And so my question for you is, How might parents be able to discern if the difference between voluntary and involuntary? Because it looks like I'm doing something voluntary, but I'm doing that thing as a coping mechanism to be able to actually pay attention in that space rather than like moving around and like getting up and causing a scene. So
So what I would bet is happening while you're sitting there is that there's a physiological response that increases dopamine and adrenaline. And you have found a way to transform that physiological response into something functional and something non-destructive. Because what you're doing is you are taking all of what would happen if you weren't knitting with all the involuntary movements that would happen, and you are channeling them into something constructive that still allows your adrenaline and your dopamine to be fed without hurting you. Without hurting the environment around you. And so I don't think people understand what the physiology is that's happening. You can't talk to someone who is having that physiology. You can't talk to someone who's in a high adrenaline, high dopamine state because they're in a primitive place. And in order to talk to them, you have to reach their higher brain center. And the higher brain center is off during hysteria, during anxiety, during adrenaline, during angst. And so there must be a lower brain way to allow for the sublimation, to allow for the siphoning of that energy towards something else. Most often, it could be connection. Touch without words, right? It could be just sitting next to somebody. It could be looking at them. It could be giving a hug. And we all know that kids who are diagnosed with ADHD are constantly being yelled at, constantly being told how dumb, stupid, pathetic, wrong, and impossible they are. And so their self-esteems go way, way down. And so they'll use the movement again as a way to get attention, because at least they're getting some feedback. But what's most often needed is connection. And what you do when you knit is you create connection to your higher self by saying, I'm going to take all of this angst, all of this. Adrenaline rush, all of this dopamine, and I'm going to siphon it towards something that's constructive so that I can actually use the part of my brain that can listen, absorb, connect, and pay attention.
So basically, this is something that parents might see if they have a child that is like me that figured out a way to do that the it could look like in voluntary action that the voluntary action is being chosen to channel the involuntary actions that are trying to come through. Is that accurate?
The physiology of what would end up as an involuntary movement if left unchecked. And what you do is you take the impulse that would be involuntary, you channel it.
Okay. Just
That's
want to make sure I.
higher brain function, right? That's what I would call adulting, right? You've coped, you found mechanisms to give yourself relief. So that upsurge of adrenaline, upsurge of dopamine, doesn't compromise your functionality. It's
It
coping.
did take me a while to figure something out like that to be functional.
One of the first ways I learned was to hold my hand, to literally see the anxious kid as the left hand and my internal parent. My own mother, father figure internally, and say, I got you. You're safe. I got you. I'm here. I got you. I got your back. I'm making it safe for you. Because the reason for the angst is because the child doesn't feel safe. And again, we have to look at why.
Yeah.
Is it food? Is it a toxin? Is it mold? Is it an infection? Is it poor vision? Is it poor sleep? Mm-hmm. Is it emotional? Is it trauma? Is it abuse? Is it neglect? Is it miasmic, right? Is it generational,
mm-hmm.
right? Is it in utero? These are all things that I try to look at
mm-hmm.
because I feel that medicine needs to be, let's go to the root cause.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see if we can find out what's happening underneath that's creating this physiology.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can adjust what's happening underneath. We can shift the brain immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Larry, ADHD has become more defined as neurodivergent in recent years rather than as a mental health condition. Can you talk to us about the shift and what's behind it?
I'm going to take a deep breath because I'm going to go in here. I think that we have become complacent that 1 in 5 children have neurodevelopmental issues, that 1 in 36 children has autism, that 1 in 9 children has been diagnosed with ADHD, and that 1 in 20 children under the age of 5 has seizures. We have started to accept that this is okay
mm-hmm.
without recognizing that not addressing the essence of who these people are, because I do agree that these kids and adults are beautiful just the way they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I also believe that part of the way in which we eat, part of the way in which we live, part of the way in which we practice medicine, part of the way in which we think, part of the way in which society is structured creates these problems that don't necessarily have to be that type of physiology.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we've allowed it because there's so many. We've said, yeah, this is the norm. When in fact, we've accepted it. We've lowered the bar on what acceptable is. And I think that we have not done justice
mm-hmm.
to what is creating adverse physiology in these people.
So you would argue that actually labeling ADHD or other conditions as just saying I'm just neurodivergent or neurospicy or whatever happens to be, that that's doing a disservice to people, and because it's you think it's accepting something that doesn't need to be accepted.
Correct. It's, and I think that, you know, like I was born in 1961, so I've had a lot of a retrospective look at life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we adore labels. We use it as a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm.
We relate to each other because of our labels.
Yeah.
We find comfort, and I put that word in italics, comfort, because we can tell people what our label is. And I think we do a disservice by hiding behind a label rather than saying, you know, there's a physiology here that is really compromising my optimal health, my mm-hmm. optimal well-being. And while I am accepting of who I am, I don't want to live with this physiology because I want to take responsibility that I don't have to live with this physiology because we've accepted it as okay.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I said, you know, next year at the MAPS conference, I've been given permission to give a talk on child development before we lower the bar.
Mm-hmm.
So we have accepted atypical outcomes
yeah.
as typical.
And there's a lot of things that go into it too. I remember even in, I have not been practicing nearly as long as you. And I remember in my lifetime seeing the change in the ease of diagnosing ADHD and the in and like so thing. And at the same time, it made it harder to diagnose autism. And it was around the same time that all sorts of ADHD medications were coming out. So there's a lot of outside influences too, where things are changing that are like, not completely irrelevant, but kind of arbitrary markers for things for like what we label something as. And I agree, like we can and absolutely should eliminate suffering in every chance that we possibly can.
I wholeheartedly agree. And that's why in the lecture, I actually ran down a list of things that could be the problem that are often ignored just to get an ADHD diagnosis. Mm-hmm. So food sensitivities, dietary reactions could be what we call ADHD. And if we modify the diet, all of this aggressiveness, impulsivity, lack of attention, inability to have executive function can go away.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that we can miss is improper sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So kids who twist and turn, kids who bedwet, kids who snore, kids who don't fully rest, kids who wake up through the night, that would almost always present with inability to sit still, aggressiveness, impulsivity, lack of executive function the next day, because those kids are still high adrenaline junkies, never get to a place of parasympathetic or quiet tone, right? Poor vision. Kids whose eyes are not working together. In other words, it's called binocular vision. And if you remember, I discussed, the Neurovisual Medical Institute, which actually checks kids for misalignments, because they can be horizontal misalignments or vertical misalignments, and ophthalmologists don't ordinarily test for it. So once you give them the proper glasses with prisms, with the right corrective lens, you actually see a kid who isn't bringing in information through their eyes that then tells the body we're in trouble. Because most people don't know that 70% of sensory input goes through the eyes. And if your eyes in the back of your head, in the optic centers, perceive a mismatch of what it's seeing, it's going to send a signal to your threat centers, we're in trouble. So there's going to be movement. There's going to be inability to sit still. There's going to be inability to focus. So diet, poor sleep, and poor vision are important to look at as possible reasons and not just label it as ADHD. And then the other things that I listed, which I think is a separate category itself, which is sugar. Another category, which is very prevalent in kids nowadays because of their access to the internet, which is porn. And other addictions. Because addictions are based in the hindbrain. That thrill seeking, that dopamine, that I need to have this, is hindbrain dominance. So allowing a child to participate in an addictive practice will keep adrenaline and dopamine very high, and that shuts off the forebrain. So video games, use of the cell phone, social media, switching from app to app to app to app to app, putting the phone down, checking it again, putting the phone down, checking it again. That literally shuts off the higher brain centers. Video games, which then continuously feeds the survival mechanism, will shut off the front brain. And what people don't understand is that when kids get up from playing the video games, they walk around like a chicken without a head. They're still vibrating in the video game. So the adrenaline level is so, so high. And then what parents report, and I've seen it, and parents talk about it all the time, aggressive behavior, irritability, reactivity, nastiness, violence, inability to connect, social isolation. And that's ADHD.
Yeah.
It stays in the hindbrain. And The last category that I presented was toxins, pesticides, electromagnetic radiation, and vaccines. These are all things that must be addressed that create a reaction in the body that says, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
As long as the body perceives we're in trouble, which is not a higher brain function, it's a lower primitive brain function, or brain shuts off.
So I'm curious. So, you know, there's all these different things that can contribute to that, to it. And all ultimately it comes down to, in many cases, a lot of what our community is going to hear is inflammation, because inflammation is what everybody focuses in on. Inflammation is what's telling them it's in danger. And as long as there's inflammation, there's going to be problems. And inflammation is at the root of so many of our chronic health conditions. So I've got a couple of curiosities here. So first, I'm curious if you feel like there is any overlap or any differentiation between the ADHD and things like anxiety, depression, dysthymia, and PANS even for that matter, or if you see them all as ultimately different manifestations or like different flavors of the same thing.
Correct. 100%.
Okay.
And it goes back to what I said earlier, Jen, is that we need a label. That's what we need, a label. We need a badge, and we need it so that we can get our medications, so that we can get our insurance to pay for things, so we can get our IEPs, so we can get our, you know, our 504s or whatever they're called in school, you know, so we can get the kids the services. I'm great with that. The bottom line is that the common thread through it all is increased adrenaline, increased dopamine, increased inflammation, wastes, toxins, impurities, and a shutdown of the body's ability to purge the level of wastes, toxins, impurities, and inflammation that must be removed in order to reestablish homeostasis. That's one of the things that I love about constitutional and classical homeopathy, because what that does is, without necessarily removing the cause, you can shift the vibration of the kid to do it him or herself.
Right.
Great. But not everybody has access to it. Not everybody understands it. And not every practitioner knows what he or she is doing.
Yeah.
And so I still believe that while you're doing something like classical homeopathy, it's important to alter the contributing factors, because if you don't, your classical homeopath is going to continuously see something that's called maintaining cause.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't help the kid at all. Yeah. So I think there's a common thread, and we can do better by asking parents to step up and really working as a team to get the kids eating differently, evaluating their sleep, evaluating their airway, maybe even going to an integrative orthodontist, going to a developmental optometrist or neurovisual optometrist, watching the EMFs, the electromagnetic fields, watching the video games, the toxins, the pesticides, the dyes, the preservatives, the additives, the food colorings, minimizing addictions, getting them off, getting them into nature, grounding them, walking on the beach, walking barefoot in the grass, going for a walk in the forest, getting outside after rain, breathing those negative ions, play outside of the dirt, and get away from the cell towers and the Wi-Fi routers and all of the things that are exciting these kids.
Yeah. I got to tell you, Dr. Larry, I am overwhelmed by hearing all of those things, and I'm not even a PANS mom. And so I'm just going to say, I agree that when we talk about it in our Facebook group and on this podcast regularly, that we do need to remove obstacles. And so much about what we talk about, especially with our guests, are about removing obstacles to health or the contributing cause. I don't remember what you called it, but we call it obstacles to health. And so I will also just put it out there for any parent who might have just felt overwhelmed with all of the things that you were saying, that yes, those are important, and we can still see progress to start those things and get maybe a little bit more ease in acceptance and cooperation from kids when we start with homeopathy. Homeopathy can help us shift our state enough that we have more acceptance of healthy foods, that we have more willingness to go outside, we have less need for the addictive things that that can help keep a kid in like a reasonable state, which is why parents will use them sometimes, because their child is so dysregulated. I know it's causing dysregulation itself, but it temporarily regulates them so that they can just function in life. So just want to put it out there for both you and for anybody who's listening who felt overwhelmed with all the things. All those things are important, and they are made easier by starting the healing process with classical homeopathy.
Beautiful. I 100% share in your passion about it. Mm-hmm. When I work with families, mm-hmm. I look at what's the lowest hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the thing that's the biggest change that could occur to bring the biggest result first? So in some families, I only do one or two things to start. Like, I don't do all of that, but if I'm giving a lecture or answering,
of course, you're going to share all of
I'm going to share as much as I can, so people understand that this is not a simple issue.
Yeah.
And, you know, I want parents to know that if they do three things and nothing's getting better, it's because there's something that's still maintaining cause. Mm-hmm. But there's something that we need to dig further into. But I often gauge the capacity of the parent to see where they're willing to start and to see what's the lowest hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. What's the thing that's most likely to bring the biggest change? It's usually the hardest thing to change, but the thing that will get the family the biggest buck, the biggest bang for their buck. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that parents are so lucky to have you as a classical homeopath, because it can shift the vibration. It can shift the frequency of the kid in no time, mm-hmm. and get the kid off the cliff, so to speak.
Yeah.
Right, get the kid off the edge, and then get the parents, you know, off the edge as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Larry, what concerns would you suggest parents look at when they're being recommended ADHD medications for their panda's child?
I know that parents are looking for ways to help their kids. And in my experience, medications are not the solution. They may be temporizing, they may be short term, but the fact of the matter is that when I see adverse symptoms, I know that the body is trying to work something out that is otherwise threatening its safety. And when symptoms occur, the symptoms are there as a way for the body to expel what is perceived as a threat. And by giving medication, you suppress the body's attempt to purge. Mm-hmm. What I end up seeing, and this is a classical homeopathy concept, the inflammatory systems go deeper into the body. Mm-hmm. And so it will create maybe short-term gain, maybe, but a lot of long-term problems. Mm-hmm. Because if we can start realizing that the development of symptoms is the body's attempt to reestablish balance, and that the body is trying to purge excess toxicity, wastes, inflammation, impurities, and by suppressing it, we can make it worse, we're going to do more disservice to these kids by using medications. But I understand that parents are at a juncture. They're at that, oh my God, if I don't do something right now, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. I don't see those kids because I don't use medications, mm-hmm. because I know that those long-term effects, the suppression of symptoms, is much more dangerous for the healing of the child and may have to result in longer term attempts at trying to help the kids and clear them. Mm-hmm. And so I usually don't see those kids in my practice.
Yeah.
Usually don't.
Yeah. We have a lot of people just because all we do is we do homeopathic consultation. And so we've got a lot of people who work, you know, we actually require a resilience naturopathic that they maintain a relationship with a local provider who can do like all medical care and everything. And so sometimes it comes up for us, probably far more frequently than it would come up in your practice. And I would say that of the psychiatric medications that are recommended to kids with PANS and PANDAS, that the ADHD medications have the least issue with suppression, in part because they're so short acting, and usually the parents, when they use them, can use them for relatively short term to get through a tough period. As long as they're still using homeopathy, we can usually get through. But I will agree that it does tend to slow the process down, and we have so many people that that we have to talk through the reality that using things to try and speed things up actually often slows things down, because much like you're saying, you know, with the way that you and I both look at health and healing and symptoms, is that it is giving us information about what we need to do or what we need to use to help the body restore balance on its own, rather than trying to just stop this symptom from happening. And sometimes that means that we have to persist with the symptoms for a bit longer so that we can actually address it, so that we eliminate the root cause, like the true actual root cause of their suffering, not just palliate or suppress the symptom that is vital information for us.
So well said. I so appreciate what you just said. In my experience, the kids who are given even the ADHD medications, besides their appetites going down, they have two very stark issues. One, their emotions deaden, or two, they become more belligerent, become more aggressive. And a lot of parents have to stop them. But I've seen too many kids just become numb. And, you know, most parents don't want that because they want their kids back.
We've seen, you know, PANS and PANDAS kids are more sensitive to everything in general, because they're seeing everything as dangerous, right? And so they have more significant and substantial reactions to even smaller doses of medications. And I would say that the kids that I see that tend to do better when they have ADHD medications for that short term, like I was talking about, but still prolongs their ultimate recovery, tend to be the ones who have the ADHD type presentation that persists outside of a flare of the PANS PANDAS episodes, versus the ones who have like ADHD presentation during flares, but then don't seem to have that presentation separate. Like the ADHD medications don't tend to actually do really anything. I don't know if you've seen the similar.
Yeah, again, I tend to see more of the kids, you know, according to the CDC, about 30% of kids with ADHD don't take medications. I usually see the kids whose parents want to avoid the medication.
Right. So you're not, you so you're not you've seen the people who are trying to avoid it from the beginning, not people who are trying to come off of it.
It's a very niche community, correct?
And we've got people, just the nature of what we do and how we do, the fact that homeopathy is not as well understood yet. We're hoping to change that. We're working to change that. That people come to us on all different spectrums from where they've been at on the medication. And so our goal is always to help work with people where they're at, with whatever they've brought to us. We can help them, and we can meet them where they're at and help them move forward.
Homeopathy is so simple to understand. I love explaining it to parents because then they get it and then they can lean in to the possibility of utilizing it. In fact, parents are not even aware that the majority of hospitals in the United States before 1913 were homeopathic
They were.
hospitals.
They were simple to understand, sort of, but hard to actually practice, which is why, you know, finding a good
Believe me,
homeopath
the
really helps.
powers that be are doing everything that they can to limit ability of practitioners to practice homeopathy. Too bad.
Unfortunately, I feel like I just have to say a quick thing because I've been sitting here really quiet, much more quiet than I normally am. Just because I think I'm sitting in the space of a learning parent, but also a learning child too. I was diagnosed with ADHD at 3 years old, or not 3 years old, third grade. I was medicated all the way through high school, on and off medication as an adult. I've never heard anyone explain that whole like hindbrain, front brain, forebrain, whatever it was. Like the fact that there are providers that are willing to have this conversation. Like I love the fact that the needle's being moved on this, that ADHD children are no longer the misbehaving, won't be still, won't clean her room, won't do this. Like it's no longer like if I was a child in today's world, I would no longer be the problem child. It's viewed differently, and it's viewed differently because you guys are willing to have this conversation and teach me, teach moms, teach everyone. And also more importantly, let us know that there's different ways to do it. Because I think back when I was a child, that's just how you did it. You know, my parents did exactly what all the other parents were doing, and we just didn't know that there were other things available. So just a lot of appreciation for what I learned today. And also, you know, what you guys are doing to, you know, just kind of shift how the world looks at this. It's awesome. I love it. I enjoyed today's talk.
Thank you, Jody. I really appreciate you saying that. I was probably a very early ADHD kid. Most ADHD kids are very intuitive. A lot of them are very psychic. Most are very, very sensitive. They're in tune, and they know that people around them are treating them improperly. They know that their spirit is being squashed, and they don't know how to get out of it. And so I try to teach parents as much as possible, please, 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 let's change the way we talk to kids. Because most of us, whether we have a kid with ADHD or not, we forebrain our kids. Do this, do that. Don't do this, don't do that. Here's the answer. Stop that. Here's another answer. Here, I'll solve this problem for you. When in fact, the forebrain doesn't develop from the outside. The knowledge, the understanding, the wisdom, the problem solving doesn't happen because somebody does it to us and plants it in our brain. It happens because we allow children to have the experience of learning in a safe environment.
Yeah.
And if we're taking that learning experience away by giving them the answer, telling them what to do, telling them what not to do, telling them where to go, telling them where not to go, and flooding them with all of this stimulation, you're going to lose them.
Yeah.
You're going to lose them. And, that's a big piece that I can talk about for hours, just on that alone, the self-esteem and the spirits of these children and how important it is to speak to them differently, to understand who they are differently, to work really hard, not to put them down, not to yell at them, not to criticize them, but to really understand that they're going through something that they can't even help and that they need our help to provide a safe space for them to emerge, to learn, to experience, to experiment, to develop their own sense of who they are without being pushed, slapped, stimulated, injected, solved, fixed, corrected, answered, which then creates a lot of very, very tough neurophysiology. So I appreciate that, Jody. Thank you for letting me say that piece, because that's the stuff I really love to talk about.
Yeah. Well, apparently we're all a group of ADHDers. You know, me, it was not caught until much later because I was given lots of other diagnoses and lots of other things going on, but there's a reason that we all came together today. So on that note of just offering love, it was really what it sounds like, offering love and acceptance and compassion to everybody, because we're all on our own path and we all have things going on that we might not be aware of. Thank you, Dr. Larry, for joining us today and for giving us all of this perspective that I think is going to be new for a whole lot of our listeners. So really, really grateful. Do you want to share anything about your preferred way for people to be in touch? I mean, we're going to put all of your stuff in the show notes. Anything you want to share with us?
I'll put the show notes. I have lots of newsletters, mm-hmm. lots of interviews I've done, podcasts. Check out everything on my website, drpalevsky.com. And I have multiple other places, Rumble, Instagram, Telegram, MeWe, Odyssey, I don't
all
know.
The things. All right, fantastic. Well, we'll make sure we've got all of the ways for people to get in touch with you should they want to learn more about you or potentially consult with you for some help. Again, I can't thank you enough for being willing to join us and share this perspective and the way that you approach health and healing, especially for people who are struggling with attention and hyperactivity. And I really look forward to continuing to see you and connect with you and learn from each other more and more over the years with MAP. So I'll see you soon.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Keep up the great work, and we'll reconvene when it's right.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.